date.
You're listening to BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now for the next part of Brian Thompson's memoir, described by The Guardian as a masterpiece. His first volume, Keeping Mum, was just pipped for the Costa Prize. Well, in today's instalment, Brian Thompson recalls his national service training. The reader is David Troughton.
There may be trouble ahead, but while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance.
S and I had what we thought of as our first real date on my 18th birthday. It included a visit to Lyons Corner House in the Tottenham Court Road, and looking back on it, both the word date and the venue have a museum dustiness. How shy we were. I was recognisable at 1,000 paces as some sort of twitty schoolboy, but S could be described as a young woman, not only for her character, but by the clothes she wore. We could have walked the length of Oxford Street that day without seeing a single garment marked out specifically for people our age. The generations had no gap. There were no teenagers. The streets were peopled with trainee adults. At Hartford Grammar, Andrew Wilkinson was encouraging us to read the whole of Wordsworth's Prelude, and not just the abridged text. He also asked me to tea at his house one Sunday. This invitation, when relayed to my mother, created havoc.
Don't tell me, he's got a little cottage in the country, far away from prying eyes, eh?
He's married.
Who is this Wilkinson?
My father asked bluntly.
Look, I have a lot of catching up to do. Everybody at that school is brighter than me.
So, this is some sort of remedial class?
If you like, yes.
The idea pleased him. Not that Wilkinson was taking pains with my education, but that I stood in need of such help. Wilkinson did indeed live out in the country. I was greeted at the door by Mrs. Wilkinson. Her smile was warm and friendly.
I'm making some tea soon. Andrew's in there, she said, pointing to a side room.
He was casually dressed, unshaven, feet jammed into a pair of unlaced tennis shoes. The tiny room was almost entirely filled by a trestle table covered with books.
I was proofreading, he explained, smiling.
I also read your stuff in here. There's no heating, but that's good. For optimum conditions in our kind of work, you need warm feet and a cool head. Double socks are the answer.
It swept over me in an instant, standing in that little room,
that man and wife could be happy, and that the life of the intellect was, in many ways, quite as prosaic as driving a bus. Andrew Wilkinson was susceptible to the same life-saving ordinariness of grinding hard work and broken furniture as our neighbour, Alf. And I realised that I, too, could live like a Wilkinson. As for S and me, we kissed and fondled as young people do. On one occasion, we went to shelter in George's allotment shed on the way home from the cinema in the pelting rain. Though we cuddled, nothing followed from it. The rain lashed down. The spiders shrank into their corners. Trains clattered past. A few doors down from us in the Eastfields, a girl fell pregnant.
Someone's put her up the stick, my mother commented. You want to watch it? It only takes a second.
A second what? My little brother asked, intrigued.
I don't suppose it's any good telling you that not everybody's sex balmy, I demanded, blushing.
No, it's not. As soon as I had completed my S-level papers, my father found me a temporary job as a furniture porter at Fishpools, a shop in the Cross. He pocketed the money I earned, giving me back the loose change. One night he came home and found me reading my examination results. I had distinctions in French and English.
So, what happens now?
His eyes were dangerous.
I stay on for the seventh term and go for an open scholarship to university.
My mother was watching us, a saucepan of mashed potatoes in her hand.
You listen to me,
Bert said, with the authority of a bishop.
You don't go back to school. You get in the army and let them make a man of you.
I told them I'd go back.
Well, untell them. You've had your notice from the National Service. That comes first.
Listen to what Hitler says,
my mother put in. But her eyelids pricked with tears. Today it is usual, especially among those who've never faced conscription, to describe National Service as time wasted. But for me, it was a blizzard of people and ideas that I never knew existed. Our lot, the unselected rabble who slept and ate together at Kempston Barracks, were all 18, but that was the only thing we had in common. There were people like myself who had just finished sixth form, and others who were strangers to the written word. In the underlit barracks, I also met my first public schoolboy, an earnest big ears called Henry. We marched, we saluted. We learned never to speak until spoken to. In time-honoured tradition of his calling, the drill sergeant swore on his mother's grave that we were the worst recruits he had ever been lumbered with. But at the end of the week, six of the intake were told to attend officer pre-selection in Bury St. Edmunds. In the Naffy hut at Gibraltar Barracks, pleasure was measured out in pennies. Tea, a butterless scone, on payday 10 woodies or a half-ounce block of golden Virginia. One night, I sat down with a bit of their headed notepaper and wrote to Trinity College, Cambridge, brushing crumbs of Bakewell tart from the text. My story was brief. Trinity had never heard of me, but I had things to offer that might interest them. Desire, ambition, devotion to scholarship, a full heart. I sealed the envelope without knowing that few students of English were admitted there. I received a laconic reply, saying that never before had the author received a letter from the Naffy, that my grades were most impressive, and that he greatly regretted that my present situation made an interview difficult. I read so far with blushing embarrassment, only to choke on the last sentence. In the light of the circumstances, therefore, he would waive normal procedures and was pleased to offer me a place in October 1955. I showed this amazing letter to Henry, who suggested I write a carefully nonchalant word of thanks and acceptance. Are you going to university, Henry?
I suppose I should, he mused, though look at the people they're letting in these days.
Only joking.
But that was the thing of it. I did consider myself an imposter.
I wrote to my mother, telling her that she must keep any letter from Trinity safe and not use it to light the boiler. Under no circumstances was she to show it to my father. On the other hand, she could tell him that I was going before a War Office selection board with a view to becoming an officer. There was leave at Christmas, and I hitched home in my ammunition boots and greatcoat. My father opened the door and studied me through a cloud of capstan full strength. His first words were utterly predictable.
Thank God we've got a navy.
My mother had hidden the letter from Trinity in a saucepan.
Who's going to pay?
She asked.
The British taxpayer. I can see the sort of people you've been hanging out with, and your father's none too pleased about this officer business.
But in the end, it wasn't the idea of having a second officer in the house that distressed him, but the offer from Trinity.
What does it tell you that you've got in just by writing some silly, scruffy letter? He huffed. Tells me something.
And what's that?
They are having trouble making up the numbers.
On this leave, S and I moved from going out to going steady. We were 19. She had joined the commuter trains as a bank clerk, but one who read Iris Murdoch and went to West End plays. She saw the world clear and whole. "Tell me about Trinity," she said. "Surely you're pleased with yourself for once." "I'm very pleased with myself," I said. "In fact, you're looking at a whole new person." I exercised my new personality by undoing her bra. "Pigeon eyes," she said, pushing me away. I do not think any of the letters I wrote to her from this time have survived, but they must have made dull reading. Did I actually send the letter that described sleet bouncing off the barrack window panes at midnight? Her letters to me were reassuringly commonplace. They went into the breast pocket of my tunic and marched with me on parade. It was the army way. If you had a girl, you wrote to her. If she was a nice girl, she replied. The War Office Selection Board was a four-day affair that concentrated on skills of a kind not often employed in anything resembling the world of real events. Split into teams, we attempted to bridge muddy pits with a 40-gallon oil drum and unequal lengths of scaffolding pole. One frosty morning, we climbed to the tops of tall trees and leapt for ropes, dangling and enticing 4 or 5 feet away. Some candidates refused. When this happened, the officer made furtive notes. "Bad luck," he said diplomatically. Just before being commissioned, I was invited to nominate the regiment of my choice. My first pick was the Royal Fusiliers, a sign of complete social ignorance. The second was the Somaliland Scouts, and the third the King's African Rifles. Newly commissioned officers had a clothing allowance of £74, with which they were supposed to buy patrols, mess uniform. Bert got me to sign this draft over to him, and my mother went off to jumble sales to find a dinner jacket as replacement. She came home with something that a musician might have worn when playing hotel gigs in New Orleans 30 years earlier. "But I'm trying to make a good impression," I wailed. "You'll get used to it." She was speaking about her own life as much as mine. Time had wearied her, and nowadays the fireworks had been replaced by a slow and melancholic mudslide. She was not yet 50, and it seemed was destined to grow old and die in Waltham Cross. S and I spent our last evening together for 16 months, going to see the film Gigi in Leicester Square, and then walking to Goodge Street, where coaches waited to take 120 of us to Northolt, whence we would fly to Kenya, a country I had barely heard of, in a continent of which I knew nothing. "You're right," S asked. "Every day," I promised. She pecked me on the lips, turned, and twinked away down the rainy pavements, her bare legs glistening.
Clever Girl, A Sentimental Education was written by Brian Thompson and produced by Amber Barnfather. And tomorrow, Memories of a Colonial War in Kenya, dubiously assisted by Idi Amin. But Brian's injured by a Christmas biscuit tin.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock. Hello, this is Jim Lee, and we've drama for you in this hour as Sophie Thompson stars in our adaptation of Wilkie Collins' No Name in a moment. In an hour, Mel Gedroich brings us a tour of Sir Quentin Blake's art studio. And later, the crime writer Francis Fifield tracks down the hidden stories of musical creativity locked within the scribbles and corrections in Elgar's Violin Concerto. Tales from the Stave at 8:30. First, though, it's the dramatic conclusion to No Name, about two sisters who've been deprived of their inheritance through circumstances beyond their control. But the fight is not over yet.
No Name by Wilkie Collins, dramatized by Ray Jenkins, with Sophie Thompson as Magdalene Vanston, Jack May as Captain Ragg, and Robin Ellis as Captain Kirk. Episode 6, December 1847. Magdalene Vanston has married her cousin under a false name in order to win back an inheritance for herself and her sister. But her husband